Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, unsung heroes of Bristol, Jerry and Anne Hicks. Their daughter, Kim Hicks, joins us to talk about their work. Fighting Bristol's rapacious land speculators for decades. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. If you have someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen ready at the end of the show.
My name's Kim Hicks, and I was born into a family of activists. My parents, Anne and Jerry Hicks, spent large chunks of their life campaigning, really, to preserve the beauty of Bristol and make sure that new stuff was worthy of the city, really.
Well, this is not an easy thing to take on because there's no reward financially in it at all, and yet for the developers, the rewards are enormous.
It's absolutely right. You're up against a huge amount of money and you have to do it with a huge amount of love.
So what would you think got them particularly interested in because, you know, it's a massive city. You've got hundreds of thousands of people and there's actually only a few generally that turn out to fight these big planning applications and the things that are going to make the city look unsightly. Otherwise, they'll just go through on the nod.
You're absolutely right. It's it seems to be that certain people develop an energy and a desire to make a difference, and then what was useful for my parents is they had a couple of big successes in battles early on. And I say my parents were one of a number of people who were suitably motivated. But I think that gave them the sense that they actually could have an effect at a time when most people just said, oh dear, you know, look what they've done, what a shame, I wish they hadn't done it, but didn't feel that they could have any influence.
Okay, so one of the first things was the filling in of the city docks. Now, where are we talking about here exactly?
Well, the whole of the floating harbour. So effectively, the desire at the time from the local politicians and so on was to make use of a massive amount of land in the city centre.
Well, hang on, this is exactly what they've done in the centre, isn't it? And they've got the cenotaph there. You've got, of course, you've got the Catholic Church, St Mary on the Quay,
yes,
that doesn't have a key
that
anymore.
It has no key.
When was that, do you know?
I'm afraid I can't tell you dates on that. That was prior to my parents' arrival.
I got a feeling 20s, 1920s, 30s maybe.
I think you're
like
about
that.
Right. I think you're about right.
So that was a massive change to fill all that in and have a little tunnel for the Froome underneath.
Yes, yes.
Which several people I know have canoed underneath there.
Yes.
Not my cup of tea, but you can. But of course, they must have looked at that, some of the big landowners in the city and the city fathers, and thought, well, we've created all this new land here.
Yes, that's
all
right.
All this new real estate out of nothing, what was just water. So let's just carry on.
Let's
fill
carry
up the whole of the docks.
The whole lot.
And
they were going to leave a few lagoons, apparently.
Right. So anyway, what happened then in the late 60s?
So, well, I think originally my parents were alerted to the fact that this was going to happen due to an amazing coincidence. A man who became very central to a lot of the battles in Bristol was a barrister called Paul Chadd. And he, I think, was getting his petrol at a petrol station, and a chap who was, I think he was a water engineer of some sort, saw him and recognised him. While they were getting their petrol, happened to say, you know, isn't it a shame that they're going to get rid of the water in Bristol? At which point Paul began to investigate and discovered that, I think at that time, it may be true now, that a dock or a piece of water that is a throughway for people, you actually have to get permission from the House of Lords to actually close off a throughway. And so he discovered this, and they also discovered that if enough people voiced a complaint about it, the city council would have to be answerable.
Because, I mean, you're up against it. I mean, let's face it, when someone says, we're going to do this, it's actually sold, is it, often as a fait accompli.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so somebody's got to then say, well, no, you're not going to be doing this. You're and it really does turn into a battle.
Yes.
So what happened with the City Docks then? What do you know about that?
So, my parents were heavily involved right from the get-go, really. And the battle was to just say, we don't want to lose our waterway.
I would have thought one of the first places to be filled in would have been around where the watershed is, that sort of area.
The whole thing was going to go, yeah. The whole of the floating harbour.
Good God, amazing.
And in the end...
So just leaving the river, basically, and the new cut.
Yeah. And in the end, just to sort of leap to the end of the story, the ruling that was given finally was that they would only be allowed to remove the use of the floating harbour if the new cut was sufficiently accessible for large boats to travel along it and so on. So then that, if you like, blasted the whole thing out.
Yes, yeah, so they would have had to sort of rebuild it, and have all new bridges.
They would have had to have had a barrage.
Wow.
And what was amazing was that not only did they want to fill in and make lagoons, they want in between any of the existing bridges that move, you know, out the way of tall ships, they wanted to put fixed bridges in between. So you would have a moving bridge and a fixed bridge, a moving bridge and a fixed bridge. You cannot believe that there was this degree of stupidity, really.
Well, I mean, the difference, if they hadn't succeeded, would have been immense with the city now, wouldn't it?
Imagine, you think how much now of the city is focused on that being, a lifestyle place to live.
The Harbour Festival would have been a sort of around a puddle, basically.
It literally would.
So this, obviously, having succeeded here in saving the docks, I mean, it's just an enormous feature of the city to this day, of course. What about the next battle, which was over something called the Avon Gorge Hotel car park, which I can hardly believe. The idea of building a car park actually right on the Avon Gorge itself in the city. This is by underneath the hotel or next to the hotel?
Exactly. So the Avon Gorge Hotel existed, and obviously they were listed buildings that it's built of, and they knew they wouldn't be able to make any alteration on the Clifton side. And somebody had this bright idea, oh, look, we have got lots of room out the back into the gorge. So they were going to sort of suspend this extraordinary and horrific car park out into the gorge. And then they were given the additional idea, well, if you're doing that, you may as well have a whole load of more hotel bedrooms on the top of that car park. So this vast development, which was going to block all views of the bridge. If you were on the portway, you wouldn't have been able to see the right-hand tower of the bridge at all. And this had gone through. It had actually gone through. They got permission. They had laid the foundation stones for the work they were going to do.
Amazing.
And fortunately, the people who had fought for the city docks or were in the midst of fighting for the city docks took up the banner and fought that one too. And they got it. They managed to get Peter Walker, who was the very new Minister of the Environment. It was a new role, a new post that hadn't existed before. He was the First Minister for the Environment, and they managed to get him to say, okay, this situation needs looking at, we'll have a public inquiry.
Well, we're very lucky that we've got a recording of your father talking about this. Can you just put that into context? Where is this recording from?
This recording is marvellous. I only came across it recently myself and was thrilled hearing my father's voice again. You know, he's been dead a good few years now. This is actually in the archive. The City Museum has various archives, and this particular interview, I think the entire interview is something like 2 hours long. It's a big
thing. Do you know where they did the interview? Was it at home?
They did it at my parents' house, yes, because I can hear the phone ringing and I can hear my mum chatting in the background when she isn't joining in. Other conversations happening in the background.
Okay, tell us a little bit about your parents and before we hear them.
Okay, so as I said, they were both artists. They trained at the Slade Art School in London, and my father, once he'd trained as an artist, decided he wanted to have a stable upbringing for his children and not rely on the sort of in and out work that you get as an artist. So he decided to train as a teacher as well. So once he'd got his teaching qualification, he looked around for where in England he might like to live with his new wife as a teacher, and came to Bristol, really liked Bristol, got an interview at Cottam School, which was then Cottam Grammar School, and got the job as head of the art department, where he remained teaching for 30 years. So it was within that that sort of secure foundation, he was able to continue his work as a professional artist in weekends and holidays and so on. And then he actually retired early at 55 and was full time as an artist at that point. But and my mum, as in those days, didn't have a job. She was at home bringing up the children, but she taught evening classes. But she was heavily involved in all these environmental battles when they turned up. I think she was known by the city council as that Mrs. Hicks, because she used to turn up there and make her complaints, you know.
Shine, oh, if you
And that was number one in the album charts and singles charts all over the English-speaking world in 1970, Bridge Over Troubled Water by Simon and Garfunkel. Okay, so we'll go back to the Avon Gorge Hotel story from 1970 now. And if you can imagine, it's like a kind of enormous white rectangle that was they were intending to just simply build right on the side of the Avon Gorge underneath the Avon Gorge Hotel, but sticking quite a long distance out. And this was going to be a car park. Unbelievable, really, thinking now that someone would even attempt to get away with it. But that's what they were doing back in 1970. So let's go back there now.
We're looking now at the Evening Gorge Post Hotel. With the Gorge Hotel, a sort of a model of what it could look like implanted on the gorge itself. And it's the Evening World, rather, of October the 14th, 1973. So what was the outcome to that? Because there's a compensation thing looming.
Peter Walker, the first Minister of the Environment, right? This was almost the first decision he made. He turned it down. But so after Bristolians had written at a time of a personal...
This was very interesting.
Had written so many letters, they'd never had letters like that before.
Because Jenny Gill took them all up by hand. So she took up letters by hand to the Department of the Environment. They were getting no letters from anywhere else in the country. All the letters they were getting from Bristol. So Peter Walker agreed to a public inquiry. The developers brought in on the first day or second day their expert who was there. He was one of these mercenary experts who goes around giving opinions as required, as they're paid for. And so he was marched in with much pomp and ceremony, and the inspector was quite obsequious, really, and said, "Oh, Mr. Dales, how very good of you to come here, you see." And he came into the... And he said, could you give us your opinion on this proposed building, Mr. Delves? They said it might be damaging to the appearance of the gorge. He said, "No, I assure you, I've looked at this building. It will cause no damage at all. In fact, it will enhance the appearance of the Avon Gorge." And they said, "Oh, Mr. Delves, we're so grateful to you for giving up your time to come. Thank you very much." And as he was stepping down, Paul Chad, who was representing us, said, "Oh, Inspector, may I ask some questions?" "Oh, I'm so sorry, Mr. Chad. Yes, would you mind remaining just a little longer, Mr. Delves? And Mr. Chad has got one or two questions to ask you." So I can remember this absolutely vividly. Paul said, "Now, Mr. Delves, I'm afraid not everybody here may be as familiar with your reputation as the inspector. So could you just tell us which buildings you yourself have constructed?" "Well, I have written one of the most well-known..." "No, I wasn't asking you what you've written, Mr. Delves. What have you actually constructed?" "I have been a lecturer." "We're not asking what you've lectured on, Mr. Delves. Could you tell us what you've actually constructed?" Of course, in the end, he had never built a building in his life. So then Paul went on to cross-examine him in great detail, and at the end of a day and a half, Delves was a broken man. And Paul finally said to him, "Now you do see what a ridiculous situation you've got yourself into." And he said, "Yes." That's it. Well, then, when Paul began to call our range of witnesses, there were an enormous number. George Ferguson was a very young architect at that time. He was, I think he was working for the local authority at that time, but he came as an independent, to give independent witness. And what was the man's name who was the old...
Beckerman.
No, the old crappy chap who was the solicitor.
Huntley.
Yes, Huntley. Huntley was the man who was the barrister for the gorge. And when George got into the witness box, he said, "And how old are you?" And George said, 2 years older than William Pitt when he became Prime Minister. And so eventually my turn came, and I was asked in, so I thought, well, I'd have a go on us. The sort of artistic technicalities. So I said, "Well, I really do think this building is far too big," and explained why I thought it was too big. And Huntley said, "What qualifications have you got?" I said, "Well, very similar qualifications to those of Leonardo and Michelangelo, you see," and explained that a Slade training gave you a training in art in general, and you didn't have to be a specialist architect to understand the appearance of things. And so he was very crabby with me, but then when he had finished, the town clerk gave me a wonderful opening by saying, "What you've said, Mr. Hicks, is really just your opinion, isn't it?" I said, "Well, no, it isn't really a matter of opinion." I said, "It is a matter of demonstrable fact." He said, "Oh, really?" So I said, "Yes, if you'll assist me, I'll show this to you." And in the middle of the room, there was a model of the the bridge going over the gorge. So I said, well, let's just look at the sight lines. So he said, well, how are we going to do that? So I said, well, I have a piece of string here. Now, if I hold this string up against the bridge and you take it down to a typical viewpoint at the gorge. No, I said, no, not there, right down there, just a bit further.
On
no, hold it down there on the portway. So he eventually got down, held this thing on the portway. And I said, now you can see there is no direct line. The whole thing is bent by the Gorge Hotel. There is no direct sight line. You can't actually see the bridge from those positions, whereas before you had a beautiful view of the bridge. So he said, oh, I see what you mean. Now, this story has been incredibly retold. Peter Abrahams tells it and Paul Chadd tells it. Paul Chadd's version is simply of my aggressive tone, he said. I'm that poor man, Jerry, who tried to cross-examine you, and you were saying to him, get down, man, lower, lower, hold it lower, you see. He tells it that far. Peter Abrahams says, and do you remember that public inquiry where Jerry Hicks, he said, I came in the door and when I looked, I couldn't believe it. Everybody in the courtroom was lying on the floor and Jerry Hicks was shouting, get lower, lower, lower. Absolute fantasy, but that's how these stories gather. But anyway, it was thrown out. The city had to pay compensation because they'd given it planning permission. And that was Smith Cox, who was the owner of the gorge, was quite happy with the compensation. And I think he gave his vote to Bristol for the chairmanship of Avon when they came over. I think he was very happy with the compensation he got. But we didn't have the hotel built.
Okay, that's a City Council archive of Jerry and Anne Hicks talking about the Avon Gorge Hotel inquiry, public inquiry, even though they got planning permission. Thankfully, the Department of the Environment and Peter Walker in 1970 called it in for a public inquiry and it was thrown out. So I'm talking to Kim Hicks, their daughter, about the history of fighting planning battles in the city. We've heard about the attempt to fill in our city docks, which was thwarted by local activists in 1968-69, and there the Avon Gorge Hotel. But there's also, of course, after that, a lot of planning seemed to be going on around the big planning, big ideas in around 1970. And after that, the ring roads, the inner ring road and the sort of outer ring road. Now, is this the same as the ring road we now know, for example, that goes from around South Bristol or not?
Not at all.
Not that one, it's further in.
It's much further in. So it was going to start along the Bath Road, and that's why you've got all those modern buildings at the bottom edge of Totterdown that come down onto the Bath Road.
Okay, so we've actually got two ring roads further out from this.
We have, yes, that's right.
And those ring roads are great, aren't they? Because you carry along and then suddenly they stop. They're not really a ring at all.
No, there's no ring to it.
Thank goodness. Anyway, what about these inner ring roads?
All right, well, you will not believe it. And it's interesting because they all tie in. One of the reasons that they wanted to fill in the city docks was a large section of these roads, and we're talking motorway width roads, were going to travel along the line of the dock. Another reason that at that time there was a lot of resistance to bringing the SS Great Britain home was that because in the plan they had, the site of the SS Great Britain, where the SS Great Britain now lives, was where they were going to have the big interchange. And the big interchange was going to swing up into the air like a spaghetti junction. It was going to land on Brandon Hill. It was going to knock down the BBC in White Ladies Road. It was going to pass through the hillside and come out in Stokes Croft. You cannot even imagine that anyone would have considered it, and yet this was on the cards. Another big battle ensued there, where they held public meetings, and people came along, and again they'd pulled down that first part of Totterdown because they were so confident that nothing would impede the growth of this road.
So, but it doesn't sound like a ring road to me. It's just following the docks down. Whereabouts was it intended to go from there?
Well, it curves around. You're asking me beyond my knowledge.
Right.
But I can find maps for you to look at. But the fact is that When they were talking about the whole City Docks idea, it was decided to bring in an expert on architecture called Sir Hugh Casson to come and give his views on what should happen in Bristol. And I remember my father saying that the booklet he finally produced after, I think it took him 2 or 3 years to do it, he suggested various things that he thought would work for the central area of Bristol and the area where there used to be all the shipworkings. But he had one illustration where he used the colour red, as in the colour red for danger, don't do this, stop now, which showed all the roads that were going to be built. And he said, you know, the city council really needs to rethink this idea of smashing the whole of the centre of the city around for these roads.
So, I mean, the 1970s were really the sort of boom time for the motor car, the idea being Absolutely. That the car had to be able to go everywhere. We're having second thoughts about that now. But in the time, they really wanted to make sure that there would be car parks in the city centre. And you can understand in a way that they needed to start, you know, I suppose the car ownership was going through the roof, quite literally. They
it
had
was.
To make sure that they didn't just end up with one great jam, maybe 2 or 3 roads coming into the city.
You're absolutely right.
So on earth do you argue against people saying that? Because for most people who maybe in the 70s have bought their first Mini or whatever, this is exactly what they want.
Yes, they want to be able to get everywhere very quickly. But if you, where are you getting to? You're getting to a nowhere. You're getting to a desert, which is just another road, another car park. So, yes, it was a question of saying, what do Bristolians care about? And I have to say, having lived here all my life, you know, I was born in Bristol. My parents came to Bristol, but I was born here, so I am a Bristolian. And it seems to me that the water is so central to what Bristol is about that if you do anything to do with the water, Bristolians come out. Bristolians want to be involved in their waterway. You know, when you think originally, they used to drain the dock, didn't they? They used to drain the whole floating harbour, and Bristolians came down and cleaned the walls.
Did they?
And they patched it, yes, when it was first designed, so that all the citizens of the city would come down and clean the walls and patch any holes and so on. And then they would refill it. Yeah.
Now, how long ago are we talking about that?
Well, it's got to be right in the very early days of it first being built.
Gosh.
So that's, you know, there is this. You think when we have water festivals and that sort of thing, when they had the big water festival, or when they have the all the celebrations that we have down there now, it is packed out. Everybody comes to the water.
That's amazing. I mean, the idea that the entire dock could have been just concreted in
offices, roads. It would have been delightful, wouldn't it?
Really, unbelievable.
The city would have been completely different.
Well, of course, the thing is, the docks actually make the city. I mean, it's like La Rochelle in France, where you've got a natural harbour, then this is why we're here.
Yeah.
So you can't just get rid of it completely.
No. It does beg a belief, really, but that's what happened.
So,
I think it was because after the war, there'd been so much damage, you know, and as you know, Bristol had that terrible bombing raid that destroyed that massive area around, which is now Castle Park. And I think people were so intent on, we must rebuild, we must go for the new, and so on.
But look, some of them had pound signs in their eyes,
oh,
didn't they?
Oh, without doubt. Of course they did.
And I don't think there's any getting away from that even today. But, I mean, one of the main groups involved in all of this over the years has been the Civic Society.
Yes, indeed.
Now, how have they changed over the years, do you think?
Well, it's interesting because I think traditionally civic societies are, in some towns, they're literally just for older people to wander around and enjoy the environment and have lectures on things. But quite a few civic societies are more animated than that and involve themselves in the planning process.
So did the Civic Society get involved in the things we've been talking about, the Avon Gorge,
they
public inquiry,
did.
The filling in of the city docks,
they
the ring
did.
Roads?
Yes. Civic Society was a strong force there, but if you like, there was a certain dryness to their presentation. It was factual, it was what you'd refer to as reactive, whereas over the years Bristol Civic Society became a lot stronger and became a lot more proactive, so they will now present ideas that they think would work for the city rather than it
so,
just
I mean,
being
the
reactive.
Obvious thing is get involved with things like the local plan,
yes.
And say, actually, we think this part of the city is best suited for this. So have they changed over the years, though, do you think, the Civic Society, much from the ones, the attitudes that you can remember from the 60s and 70s?
I would say that the Civic Society now is incredibly efficient. They've got, you know, their publications are fantastic if you read them. They're really on the money. Perhaps bearing in mind, obviously, I'm biased. When my father was chairman, he had a more, what shall we say, if you like, emotional response to things. Mm. So when you hear him speak, you hear him speak with a great deal of passion, which I think is effective. And I think maybe in the current civic society, they're so good at what they do, maybe they're a little bit quiet on the emotional
You know what? I think it's quite a lot of organisations like that today, whereas in the old days, he says, in his mid-50s, they used to be a sort of understanding that any of these kind of civic groups, civic society or any other group, really, you would make sure that as a chairperson, you would have somebody who really captured the spirit of what the people were trying to do. Whereas nowadays, seems to me you've got a kind of one-upmanship, and a lot of that involved where
I think it's not considered cool now, is it?
People want to, you know, they get a certain ego boost about being the person in charge, and they're not necessarily the best person for the job. I just have seen that, I think, in a lot of groups that I've seen over the years. But anyway, look, let's get on to today, because when we're starting to talk about the civic society and others being proactive, and it's really needed today because the developers in Bristol have been given basically a green light by the mayor. Build up, they say.
Yes, this is a tragic thing. In the past, we had a very useful document that told developers coming to the city that buildings above a certain height were not really welcomed. That didn't mean to say you couldn't build above that height, but you had to have a good reason to do it. Now, in the new city plan, you have this thing which says, actually, we welcome tall buildings. Now, that's not what all of us want by a very long stretch. And I don't think the difficulty is people don't realise how tall is. Our tallest building at the moment in Bristol is Castle Mead, isn't it? I think that's about 18 stories tall. And that's beside Castle Park. Now, already...
Yes, remember, we are a medieval city, yes, folks. We're not some new town, or we're not New York, we're not LA.
And we don't wish to be New York or
no,
LA.
Thank you.
But now the planning permission has been given for a building which I believe is 26 stories high alongside Castle Park. So imagine if you've got an 18-storey building, that's another 8 stories on that. So we're talking about half as high again, aren't we? It's breathtaking that's been... just pushed through.
But this is about money, isn't it? Because every square inch of land is worth X. Well, it's worth it's X times however many floors you can put on top of it.
Yes.
Is it really that simple?
I think there's more to it. I think that the area where the council is hugely under pressure is national government has told Bristol we must build however many it is, 30,000 new homes in whatever the length of time is, very soon. It's a massive number. I'm quoting completely in the air here, but I just know it's tens of thousands of houses are required. And unfortunately, the attitude they're taking is the only way to achieve this is by saying, what space have we got in Bristol? All that's left is the sky. Let's go up. But it's not acknowledging the fact that building higher is more expensive. Ecologically, it's less friendly. There's quite a lot of research that suggests that being forced to live high is very unhelpful for elderly people who get very lonely. For families, they say that mothers with small children in these places suffer from more depression and so on. So there's a lot of reasons why you shouldn't build high, let alone our recent horrific example of the Grenfell Tower in London, where you say, what is the safety of these tall buildings?
Well, some people will say, actually, what's happened is over the years, for housing purposes, blocks of flats have been being built by the council themselves quite high.
Yes.
So why shouldn't other developers come along and do the same?
This is it. So you get the thin end of the wedge, if you like. Once the first one's allowed in, then we can just say, give carte blanche to the developers to do what they like. And that is the scary place we're in at the moment, that unless we really make our feelings felt and don't stop after one building, where, you know, one, let's suppose we have a victory and one building is prevented, there's going to be another one, and we have to be able to gird our loins and fight the good fight each time. And we're in a I don't know that it's quite such a groundbreaking time as that period in the 70s with the city docks and the Outer Circuit Road and so on, but it's not far off it. It's a pivotal time where the city has to make a decision. What sort of city do we want to be?
Well, we've seen is a kind of vision for Hot Wells and the docks, and they're changing the name of it and all sorts. So can you just tell us what's being planned there? Or what's the vision? What's the idea?
Well, I wish I understood it. I'm still at the stage myself.
I mean,
of
looking
trying
at
to
the pictures,
it.
which came out in the Bristol Post, I think it was late 2017 or early 2018. There's a whole load of kind of high rises. It looks a little bit like the area around St Philip's, towards St Philip's anyway, around the back of Temple Mead Station.
Yes,
near the Dings, where you've got lots of I suppose, so some of it's social housing, but most of it are blocks of flats which are about 5, 6, 7 stories. But this, in the Hot Wells area, they're talking about going much higher.
Absolutely. I think they're taking their lead from the fact you've got the old red brick buildings there already, which are quite high, and they're saying we can go a lot higher than that. It's going to mean a complete rerouting of the road, unless they change their mind on that. That everything is still fairly early stages, but the scary thing is that you see them setting these things in motion one after the other, so there's a whole load of things going, which makes it very hard for people to pick what they're going to react to.
So this is the area around Hot Wells, and on the opposite side, the park.
Yes.
This whole area now they're calling Western Harbour. It's almost as if the mayor, Marvin Rees, has got a little map of that area, given it to some of the most hawkish developers he could possibly find, and said, right, if I was to give you this land for free, what would you really love to do with it? And that's the plans we've seen, which is, you know, not a lot of roads, but they're talking about putting some kind of road underneath the harbour and just building lots and lots of houses. Now, I just wonder, and building up very high too, I wonder how many of those houses are going to be affordable to Bristolians to buy? How many are going to be bought by investors, by buy-to-let people?
Yes.
But anyway, that is would be an enormous great change, and then a challenge, I suppose, equal to something like the things that we've been seeing, the Ring Roads, the City Docks, the Avon Gorge. That is a huge battle which is only just starting, really.
It is. It's just beginning now. And I mean, I think your comment about will it be affordable? They talk about these tall buildings have got to have at least 20% or 30% affordable housing. Well, A, I'd like to know affordable to whom. They don't talk anything about social housing. So you're presented with this picture, Bristol must provide housing for people. Yes, we agree. Bristol needs to provide housing.
And then at the State of the City address that Marvin the Mayor does every year, he'll be saying, well, we have a great achievement. We've built X number of houses. Well,
but
actually,
most of them won't be affordable to people.
No.
And what is infuriating is, historically, developers will agree that they'll do 30% affordable in this building. And then once they're building, they say, actually, it's not going to work out. We can't make sufficient money. So we're going to have to reduce the amount of affordable housing, and they're allowed to reduce it. So you can't even guarantee that you're going to get that.
There's actually millions and probably tens and hundreds of millions of pounds to be made in this little process, isn't there? I mean, we look at, for example, the Bristol General Hospital, what happened there, where you've got, I mean, I can remember going for I think it was a physio appointment or something there maybe 10 years ago.
Yes.
Then the UHB Trust under John Savage, the former master of the Merchant Venturers, sold it off to some developers, now Shutter Hospital, sold it off. And they then just refused to start building. Although they got planning permission for some social housing and affordable housing there, they said, well, we're not going to start building it until you let us have all luxury housing here. And these are the sorts of games which are played, which can net them absolutely enormous sums. We're also in another bit of a problem, and that is that sometimes the prices that they're asking are so high that nobody can afford to buy them.
Yes.
And they're quite happy because they've got their permission to build them, so they just let them sell at a very, very slow rate. Talking about Finsel's Reach, for example, which is the old brewery site around there, right in the centre, opposite Castle Park,
yes,
where the new bridge is. In there, they they just didn't finish building the place. I mean, they this is exactly the same thing as Prince Charles has been doing down at Poundbury in Dorset, is he's got planning permission for hundreds and hundreds of houses, but they're not built because the ones that have been built haven't yet sold. So they start building as they sell. Now, this is the way to squeeze the maximum possible you can out of each house build, and you know, they maybe they make a little bit more money, but this seems to be what they're doing nowadays. So they might get the planning permission and then maybe just sell it on to someone else to build, or take 10 years to build the places. So there are quite a lot of little groups around the city actually doing stuff, aren't there? So it's not just one or two, the civic society, people like yourself. There is the Windmill Hill and Malago Community Planning Group.
They're brilliant.
And because they're facing a lot of stuff going on in Bedminster, high-rise places in Bedminster.
Exactly.
That the design of which has been compared by people in Bedminster to Trump's wall going up in Bedminster. Now, this is what happens is you get, with bad planning, is you get a house and a garden, and right next to it, basically a wall going up.
And can you imagine
nearly 20 stories or so?
Quite apart from the visual height of it, can you imagine the shadows that's going to cast? At different times of day, there will be these massive shadows cast across people's houses and people's gardens. It's appalling.
Well, this is why it matters that you've got, I mean, you're overlooked as well, of course, you know. So if you have inappropriate, you know, one of the things I can remember when IKEA got planning permission was, hang on, and you can see this if you're driving out of town on the M32 on the left hand side, you've got little terraced houses next to what looks like a giant, you know, 500 foot high Lego brick next to them. It looks ridiculous, it looks bad and ugly. And actually quite a lot of what we're talking about is about aesthetics, isn't it?
It is. It's a big mixture. And the trouble is, if people want to dismiss the argument, they'll say, oh, it's all about aesthetics, but what about the fact we need to house people? And it will be pushed into a sort of different zone so that you're made to feel guilty because you don't want to house people.
There are these homeless people in a queue waiting with their goods and their belongings, and they're probably sleeping in a shop doorway.
It's true, but the bottom line is, I have it on good authority from architects that if you're up to at least 20 stories on the same footprint of land that you would require for a 20-story building, you could put two or three buildings of low and medium rise and fit in the same number of dwellings in a much nicer, more compact, interesting environment than this thing that shoots up into the air. So why are they not looking for opportunities to do that?
Well, these are exactly the sort of conversations that you'll be having down in WAM, which is West Windmill Hill and Malago Community Planning Group. Fantastic lot. And in fact, you can find them online at WAM Bristol. That's whambristol.org.uk. But at the end of the day, we do need houses. So where are they going to go? This is the question I'm sure you've been asked many times. It's all very well to criticise, but actually you can curse the darkness, but you've also got to hold a lamp up. You've got to say, no, let's do it better, let's do it like this.
Exactly.
Do you say that?
Exactly. I think you're absolutely right. It's no good just saying don't do it. We need to be able to source ideas and designs that will show how the same area of land that they're looking at, or similar. I don't like the idea of them breaking into the parkland in the Hot Wells development.
It's not Hot Wells anymore. It's Western Harbour.
I beg your pardon, Western Harbour. Thank you very much. that you know, if they're going to be destroying parkland for that, I can't see how that's acceptable. But you're absolutely right. One cannot just stand there and say, don't do it. We have to actually say, this is how we want it. We need our architects. We need some of our architects to poke their heads above the parapet and actually risk saying, we don't like what's happening in the city. We think it could look like this.
Actually, in a way, the city council needs to do that, don't they? They need to say, well, here's a piece of land. We would like to redevelop it, and let's have different ideas.
Wouldn't
it seems to me
Wouldn't
what's happened
great?
Is the developers, who do call the shots to a large extent in many cities, have gone to the mayor's office and they've said, well, this is what we're going to do. and the mayor has simply just picked up a piece of paper and been told this is what we're going to... I don't think he's had really hardly any input into this at all. He's not an architect.
Yes, I don't... When I heard him use that phrase, aspirational cities build high, I thought, well, that's developer speak.
That's not your words, Marvin.
No, that's developer speak. And you know, I would say to that, aspiring to what? I would say Bristol should aspire to be Bristolian. Bristol should aspire to be different and to be creative. You look at the fantastic art scene in Bristol. We have a host of really creative people here. And you're absolutely right. If the city council, instead of saying this developer's going to give us this, now argue with it, you say, OK, this is a piece of land we've got available. Architects out there, give us your ideas and worked out a way to make that manageable. I'm sure there's lots of reasons why they'd say they couldn't do that. But why not try and seek out something really original?
Have an intelligent discussion around the different designs and come to a conclusion which is best for the city in the long term.
Yes.
And that actually would start to reward the better architects, wouldn't it? And there would be an incentive on all the architects to say, actually, we can do better than that.
We can be
last
creative. I think they would love it if they were given that opportunity.
Yeah, at the moment, what it is, it's basically just bums on seats. Who can get the highest density of bed spaces and floor space, a number of residential units into, because that's what everything seems to be being converted to now. Mm-hmm. There's very little of anything else other than maybe a bit of retail occasion. Well, actually, the retail scene is starting to die, isn't it? They've got drones flying in pizzas and things like that, you know. So it's just about bums on seats. That's all it seems to be about. With this Western Harbour, which I think is probably the biggest of all of these, Bedminster's horrendous, that tower blocks they're building there. But that is, the only reason that's happening, if the BBC is to be believed, is because 75% of the land is owned by Marvin Rees, the mayor, city council. And so doesn't that kind of tell you what's going on here? The developers are after them. They've got their eye on that, and they seem to have the ear of the mayor.
Well, they know that he has he is very powerful in Bristol at present. You know, the mayoral position is an extremely powerful position, and you only have to get the wrong people getting the ear of the person with the power, and you've got trouble. I mean, while we're talking about these high buildings, I just wish everyone would realise, when they see pictures of them shown to them, how this lovely new development is going to look, almost invariably, the pictures are from the air. Now,
even the models, you're looking down on them.
You're looking down on them.
Yeah.
So when you look at them from the air, unless some poor aircraft gets diverted from Bristol Airport, this is a view no one is ever going to have of this building. And yet this is the view that sells it to people. Oh, that looks a nice development. That looks very smart. But if the designs, if the developments were shown from the ground and you were looking up at how colossally high they were going to be, and you were made aware of how big the shadowing would be and all that sort of thing, you might think very differently. I think it's extremely devious the way these buildings are sold to us.
The words used as well, like affordable housing.
Yes.
Unbelievable, isn't it? Anyway, Kim Hicks, fascinating to chat to you. I wonder if you just want to finish by mentioning any kind of groups around the city you think are worth chasing down if people are concerned about these sorts of issues, other than no?
Well, I would suggest people have a really good look at the site that Matthew Montague Pollock has set up about fighting high-rise buildings.
A couple of big developments coming soon are, well, there's what was going to be the arena, which isn't anymore.
No.
It's the university that's got that. And by the way, the committee at the City Council, which meets to do with the universities, the schools and general training, is secret. Group now.
Is it?
They have no public scrutiny. Public are not allowed to go along to the meetings. The minutes aren't published. So these people are getting on with it without actually any proper public scrutiny. So we've got that. Do you know what's happening at the Temple Mead site? How high that's likely to go?
Again, we're talking a couple of really tall buildings and then some shorter ones alongside that's supposed to make it palatable.
Anywhere else to point out at the moment?
At the moment, the ones that concern me at the moment are that one, the Bedminster one, which, as we said, Wham is doing a really good job of trying to oppose, but they need the support of the people of Bedminster. So anyone who can join with Wham and have a look at what they're doing, please do. I'd also recommend that anybody who's interested in this whole thing looks at the BristolAgainstHighRises.com site, which will give you an awful lot of very interesting information about the not just the negative side of high rise, but the challenges that high rise brings to an area when they come in.
The backlash, it seems to me, is just beginning against this policy, because as ugly buildings start to appear, people start to get a bit animated. I mean, you know, it's not just you, it's not just me. There's many people now starting to look at this.
Once people see them, they'll suddenly go, oh dear, why's that been put up?
And why did no one ask me? I'm living in its shadow.
Yeah.
Anyway, Kim, I'm sure your parents, Jerry and Anne, would be proud of you carrying on the tradition of trying to care for our city's aesthetics.
I believe Bristol has always come out when the going gets tough, and I think Bristolians will do the same again. And if I can just encourage everyone to get involved, look at what's coming in your area, write your letters, involve your local councillor. It's your councillors who are your voice in the council.
Also, the councillors are quite good at pointing you towards any local planning groups that are around. They're all over the city. They're dotted all over the place.
They're very, very helpful. And you know, and let's encourage our mayor to be a wonderful mayor who brings the best out of Bristol, because he can do that. He's got a lot of energy. He's got a lot of ideas which are incredibly important. And one shouldn't end up sort of saying, oh, he's the bad guy in this. He just needs to have better voices in his ear, and then we'll get something really good out of him.
Finally, do you think there's been much difference between George Ferguson as a mayor and Marvin Rees as when it comes to these sorts of issues?
Yes, I believe there has. I believe George came to Bristol as an architect.
We heard him
with
in the clip earlier, talked about, didn't we?
Yes,
a young architect.
So as a really young man, he was already fighting for what was good for Bristol. We know the benefit that Tobacco Factory, for example, has had for Bedminster and the whole area there. So he came with a different set of very important benefits. Marvin brings his own, but we need to make sure that he gets to hear the angels as opposed to the devils, who are the developers.
Well, the vultures, yeah. And it's almost as if they've hypnotised him. I think something needs to break the spell somehow.
I think you're right.
So, Kim Hicks, the daughter of Jerry and Anne Hicks, great campaigners in the city for a better, more beautiful city. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Suggest interviewees, subscribe to our email list, and listen the week before broadcast if you like at our website, dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, that's Kim Hicks, daughter of Jerry and Anne Hicks, who fought Bristol's land speculators for decades, and also to studio engineers Dave Bazanko and Joss Chivers. Dialects, a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk. We can call them on Bristol 909 6897. If you have some of your precious time to spare, you can volunteer with us, or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday, midday, from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.
gave you. You said you didn't want a friend or lover, that your life was happy with another. But as time went by, my love grew stronger. I knew that I just couldn't wait.